Hi, this is Farah Osbeck. Welcome to Military Law and Life Matters, the podcast that arms you with knowledge so you don't become a victim of injustice. So this is a part of my podcast series where I interview attorneys who focus primarily on the military community. Many, but not all of the attorneys are former military JAGs, but they all have a passion for serving the military community. I'm very excited to be speaking to attorney Davis Yontz today. Davis Yontz is an experienced military law attorney with 20 years of experience. He's a former active duty judge advocate who served as the chief of military justice at the Air Force JAG school and as a staff judge advocate at multiple wings. In 2011, Davis was ranked the number one senior defense counsel in the United States Air Force. He's currently a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force Reserve, but he's almost retired, actually. As a civilian, Davis focuses civilian law legal practice on military law, including courts-martial defense, adverse actions, and military records corrections. I spoke with Davis almost a year ago, back in March 2022, about his work helping service members who were fighting to stay in the armed forces for refusing to be vaccinated on the DoD vaccine mandates. And on 10 January of this year, I was reading the DoD news and saw the Secretary of Defense, Austin, issued a memo rescinding the vaccine mandate. As soon as I read that, I reached out to Davis and asked him if he would come back on the show, you know, just to discuss the memo and provide any insight he has, because he's heavily involved in these vaccine mandate cases, court cases, discharge boards. So I thought he'd have some great insight to share with us. He agreed, and basically I'm going to introduce you very shortly. And so stay tuned for that. Hey, good morning, Davis. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing well.
Good, good. So glad that you were willing to come back on the podcast, Davis. I know I interviewed you almost a year ago in March 2022 to help explain to our listeners the DoD vaccine mandates and all you were doing to help fight for the service members who had, you know, requested exemptions. And in January 10th, as soon as I read that Secretary of Defense memo rescinding the mandate requirements, I thought, oh, I got to ask Davis if he'd be willing to come back on. So thank you so much, because there's a lot of questions I have, and I know you're like the perfect person to help fill me in on, and fill our listeners on what's going on. So first, Davis, I want to ask you, you know, I did some research, and, you know, the memo was due to basically the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2023. The HR 7776, which and there's a section in there, 525, I read, and it basically required the rescission of the vaccine mandate. So can you tell me, what do you believe was the impetus for that bill, and, you know, that became law? Like, why exactly did they rescind it?
You know, I think that's a great question. And it was Congress. It was a concerted effort by a bipartisan group within the House to end the mandate. A lot of it is due to just pressure on congressional representatives. There were a lot of congressional representatives that wanted to do more. They wanted to include restoration of military members that were discharged over the mandate. They wanted to do other things to correct military records, as well as consider things like back pay for those that were discharged. None of those things happened, but the bipartisan compromise was to force the Department of Defense to end the mandate. I think, you know, one practical reason is a readiness issue. The Department of Defense is facing recruiting shortages and real retention issues. And there's absolutely a connection between the policies behind and the vaccine mandate, is just sort of, as well as the handling of it and just the treatment of religious accommodations and things like that. So I do think that there were those that just don't believe the mandate is appropriate and are concerned with the way it's been handled by the Department of Defense. In addition to that, there was a real practical readiness, retention, and recruiting issue.
And I know there's court cases that, you know, there's a lot of, I know that you're involved in court cases actually litigating these issues. And I, you know, I initially thought, oh, like the court cases, what role do you think the court cases challenging, excuse me, the mandate had on it? Was that also a factor?
I do think it's a factor. And again, it's a very practical reason when we think about federal litigation. You know, the Department of Defense is facing every case where a federal judge has fully looked at the denials of religious accommodations has concluded that the Department of Defense was violating service members' rights under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and not doing proper reviews. It's consistent with the finding of the acting Department of Defense IG. And so while those cases have not gone to trial, multiple federal courts have issued injunctions preventing the Department of Defense from taking further adverse action against military members. So with that as a backdrop, you and I both know, having served in the military, that sometimes what's going on in federal courts does have an impact on policy. So I certainly believe that there were some in the Department of Defense that see those cases as potential losing cases and don't want to go through the ordeal of litigation on those cases. The problem is, while I do think that could be a factor, the problem is those cases aren't going away because the current policy doesn't restore many of my clients that are involved in that litigation. There's still outstanding issues.
Okay. So, Davis, let's start with the memo. I have the memo right in front of me. I printed it out. And let's start with the one thing we know, it rescinds it. Like, that's the one thing. Okay, it rescinds. But that's not the right. It rescinds the vaccine. There's not going to be any for people going forward. I mean, there's no requirement. There's no need for religious accommodation requests, right? Like, that's one thing we can clear up, correct?
That's right. There is no mandate for military members to receive the vaccine or a booster or anything related to it.
Okay. So can you just go through the memo and tell, like, so what else does it address? Like, there's a few things it does address as well. Can you discuss that?
Right. So one thing it does is, in addition to stopping the mandate, it says that any individual that submitted a religious, administrative, or medical accommodation request will not be discharged. So wherever they're at in that process, if they're still serving, this stops processing of their discharge. So that's another important thing that it does. The other interesting thing that it does is it does look backwards and says, okay, anyone that submitted a religious or medical exemption and received adverse paperwork, so received in the Air Force a letter of reprimand, in the Army a GOMAR, formal admonishment, censorship in the Navy, any of those things, any of those adverse personnel actions are to be removed from the file, removed from the record under this guidance. Again, it impacts those who submitted the accommodation and the accommodation was denied.
Okay. So yeah, I'm looking at that paragraph. It says update that. So it's good that it says the military departments will update. So I guess if there's an LOR or whatever, they remove it, right? They can do that. But I just thought I was talking to you. What if it's, do you have any idea, like, what if it's written in the, you know, have an LOR, it's reflected in someone's performance reports, right? So is that a BCMR issue, or is that they're going to go and redact that? And then if they, let's say the services did redact it, right? But then the whole OPR is messed up, or EPR, because then there's like a blank, right? They're
right.
Because it's supposed to fill, but I don't know. Do you have any idea? It doesn't seem to address that in that paragraph.
Oh, I have a lot of thoughts, and there's a ton of issues. We could spend a long time talking about the issues related just to that. As you know, because you've worked with BCMR cases like I have. And so the issue is exactly that. You have thousands of military members who receive some sort of adverse paperwork. That paperwork's removed, but their military record is still a mess. And it's a mess for a lot of different reasons. One is absolutely the performance reports. This memo does not address that at all. And you and I both know the only way to fix it would be to go back and create a new performance report, which can be done. I mean, the Board of Corrections can order that. They can order that, but that's what would have to be done. This memo does not address that. The other huge concern I have is, on the most extreme level, I have clients who were commanders that were fired because they submitted a religious accommodation request, right? They didn't even wait for denials or anything else. They were removed from command positions, many of them for cause. So now you're a lieutenant colonel or a colonel, and you have a removal for cause from a command position in your record, that's a big problem.
Yeah.
That's a big problem. This memo doesn't address that. And the other piece is I have clients, whether it's pilots or others, that, that weren't able to deploy. Many pilots were not flying for 8-10 months. Other folks couldn't go to military education. They couldn't go to upgrade training or other types of training. So even without, even if they didn't get adverse paperwork because they were protected by the injunctions in one of the federal cases, their performance reports don't look good and their career progression has definitely been damaged. So those are the other issues that I'm looking at with my clients to try to come up with remedies, whether it's through the BCMR or through federal courts. Honestly, I think a lot of it's going to have to come through legislation.
Going for like the people whose lives were affected, I just don't feel like they're never going to get back to that square one. That's impossible. Right. Do you agree?
I agree. And the best way I can explain it is just, you know, to give an example. So, you know, I won't mention a name, but just, you know, I had a female lieutenant colonel client, a colonel in a command position, in a leadership position. She'd been serving in the command position for about 6 months when the mandate came out. She was removed from the command position because she submitted a religious accommodation. And then so she didn't have a full command tour. Her performance reports don't reflect a full command tour. She had a removal for cause from command. And even though she was protected by the injunction in federal court preventing further adverse action against members of the Air Force, her career has been on hold for 18 months, critical 18 months as an O6 for future promotion and things like that. And now the only way to try to fix some of those issues would be to go to the Board of Corrections for Military Records. You're looking at another 2 years. So you're, you know, 3.5 to 4 years of career destruction. I mean, she's just going to have to retire, and there's no overcoming this for that. And so there are a lot. I mean, there are thousands of active duty, just talking about the active duty military members in that situation. So yes, we can go to the Board of Corrections. Yes, we can try to do those things. But it's not going to make them whole. And then we can talk about reservists and those that were already kicked out as well, because the reservist issues are very significant.
Also. Yeah, I want to ask you that. But I do actually, because I listened to an interview recently about a reservist that I think you're the attorney for, because and I'm saying that because she mentioned that on the interview. But I remember in my arguments trying to argue against the bad conduct discharge, I would always say it's an ineradicable stigma. Do you remember that? That was because that was part of the military judge's instructions. And what happened, and we're talking, this is when I was like 93 time frame or not, no, 90. No, 95, whatever. I was a defendant a long time ago. But I remember that seemed to be so effective in my sentencing arguments, preventing, like, you know, even people using drugs from getting BCDs, that the prosecutors would ask the judge to preclude me from using that term.
Yes.
It was so fun. And I was like, what? And then the judge would actually, like, grant it, but it was part of the struggle. The reason I thought of that is I really believe this is now kind of an ineradicable stigma. Like, I just thought of that. It's a stigma on these people because nothing is going to, like, it's great they rescinded it, you know, for these, you know, a lot of important, it's not people willy-nilly just saying there's, you know, certain legitimate reasons, but it's a stigma on these people. So I just thought of that because it was so funny. They were like, we don't want her to use those words anymore, ineradicable stigma. But go, Davis, I want to ask you. So I did listen to an interview with a lieutenant colonel, and she, you know, she was on the news, so I can say that I think her name is Brandy King. She's a C-5 pilot, a reservist. So, and you're her attorney. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about her and what her sticks? I know she's been in 19 and a half years, so that got my attention. But what's the deal with that case?
Yeah, so hers is an example of the things that have happened. So a highly successful C-5 pilot in the reserves. She was hired by the reserves, specifically by senior leaders at Air Force Reserve Command, to serve on active duty as the chief of diversity programs for pilots, specifically to recruit female and minority pilots to increase the number of diversity and make it more attractive for female pilots to serve in the Air Force. Really, really important, critical position. She was handpicked for it just based on her experience, other successful things she's done. So she started that active duty tour as a reservist. She was very successful in it. Things were going very well. She was meeting all expectations. And then the mandate came out, and based on her religious faith, she had to seek an accommodation. She was brought into her leadership's office and asked, are you going to submit a religious accommodation? She said yes and did. And within hours, she was fired. She was removed from that position as the chief of rated diversity, removed from her orders, her active duty orders as a reservist, put back into a reserve status. Her religious accommodation was denied. She appealed it. It was also denied. Then based on guidance from a physician, she submitted a medical exemption request that was denied. She received a letter of reprimand that specifically stated, the letter of reprimand states that she filed a medical exemption after the deadline to submit medical exemptions, that she was derelict in her duties by filing it late. And then after her religious accommodation appeal was denied, she was given a letter of reprimand based on not getting the vaccine. And then she was involuntarily pushed into the individual ready reserve, which we'll talk about what that means in a moment. But that's exactly what happened to her. Lieutenant Colonel Brandi King, I mean, just phenomenal, a human being, phenomenal officer, phenomenal pilot, has done everything right in her career. And that's what happened to her. And unfortunately, the injunction in the Air Force case didn't come in time for her, you know. So at mm-hmm. every step of the way, you know, it felt as if Air Force Reserve Command was in some respects trying to make an example of her. And, you know, she didn't go public until she's been stuck in the reserve in the IRR for so long. But that's her situation. And the IRR piece is really, really important. And you can understand this. When a reservist is put into the IRR, especially involuntarily, they're in a holding pattern where it is very, very difficult to earn any pay or points. You lose your health care benefits. You lose access to TRICARE Reserve. So you're stuck in this holding pattern, and you can only stay there so long before you're separated as a participating reservist, period. So, you know, she was pushed into that. Now she's at 19 and a half years, but she doesn't have 19 and a half years of points because she's been sitting in the IRR for almost a year now.
Oh, wow. So she does. So, and I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, you can only stay in IRR status for a certain time. Is that true?
That's right. That's right.
What is that, like 2 years? Do you know?
I think it's 2 years. I think it's 2 years.
Okay. So if God forbid, if another year passes by and she's passed that 2 years and she only has the 19 and a half, you know, the points, whatever, the
how right.
She will basically be separated without a retirement.
That's right. She'll be wow. separated without a retirement and without access to those benefits. And she has already asked, and I've asked for other clients. I have other clients that are in the IRR, and we have asked, and so far the answer has been, no, there's nothing in the memo that requires us to do anything for you or get you back assigned to a unit or anything else. So the early, now I will say this in fairness, the Air Force Reserve have not come out with specific, you know, service specific policy after this memo yet. That mm-hmm. should come within the next week or so. But as it stands now, indications from the chain of command for all of my clients have been, if you're in the IRR, you're not our problem anymore. We have no interest in bringing you back.
Wow. Cause they don't, I mean, do they have, I guess they're waiting for policy. Could the Reserve Command come out with their own policy saying,
because, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So why, so they're probably waiting for, I'm assuming, some type of policy from the Air Force. Like they could come out with their own, but they want the Air Force to perhaps come out with the policy. I'm hoping. And I hope it's, wow, that's a, Yeah, I mean, obviously she wouldn't have been chosen for these jobs, like you told me that I didn't know that, you know, unless she was very talented and, you know, had great character, et cetera. And it's just a shame.
Set aside sort of the opinions about the vaccine or not, and we can, I mean, we can just focus on the medical and the religious pieces of this, and I think then people can understand the injustice that's involved here. You know, you have just this decision by the Department of Defense, the services, to ignore the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the requirements of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And the other piece of this that isn't talked about enough yet is just the medical exemption process. You know, the military medical providers, and I represent several, but military medical providers were told very, very clearly that the only exemptions they can grant, the only medical exemptions they can grant, are for people that are pregnant, people that have COVID, have an active case of COVID, or individuals that had an adverse reaction to a dose of the COVID vaccine. So the problem with that is there's a whole lot of other medical conditions, medical histories, and things like that that the FDA and CDC would say are contraindications for getting this any of these vaccines, and the military denied those medical exemption requests, just point, as a matter of policy. I have a client that went to a board, an Air Force client went to a board. His primary care physician, as well as an Air Force family medicine doctor, both recommended do not get this vaccine because he had two siblings. My client had two siblings, both had severe adverse reactions. They have a family medical history. My client also had adverse reactions to two different families of antibiotics. The CDC says, hey, if you have negative reactions, if you've had negative reactions to two different families of antibiotics, you probably shouldn't get these vaccines because there's some correlation. I don't understand what the correlation is, but that was in CDC guidance. So he went through the process, submitted all the paperwork to the Air Force, and that medical exemption was denied. And he was told it's denied as a matter of policy. And he was told in writing by an Air Force 06 medical provider, well, if you're concerned about an adverse reaction, just go and get the first dose in the hospital. Get admitted to the hospital and get the first dose. That way, if you go into anaphylaxis, they can revive you.
Oh my God.
So again, there are
I
horror
can't.
stories. There are horror stories, but
Oh
that, I
my
mean,
God.
you know, but that's a client we actually went to an administrative separation board for based on that. So, you know,
And he was he retained. I remember a case I read
he was
actually in the paper. Was he the re when you was retained?
not retained.
Oh,
He
he
was not
wasn't?
retained. They
Oh my
the
gosh.
board recommended separation. Now, there were some interesting factors there because you'll find this funny. He was pursuing a PhD program, and the Air Force had paid for it. So the board recommended separation, but they recommended an honorable discharge, and they said there was no factual basis for the Air Force to recoup his education. So that I think, honestly, I think they tried to do him a favor. They're like, you know what? You should just get your PhD and move on with life with an honorable discharge rather than dealing with any more of this nonsense. It's
How many
extremely
years was
likable.
he in? How many was that number? Do you
Not
remember?
about nine,
Okay.
not that long. So yeah, so that was, I mean, you know, juries and boards do interesting things. So
Yeah.
that was a fascinating outcome. But that was one of the worst from a medical perspective. But I'm sorry, I went off on a tangent
No,
there.
I can't believe when you, but the thing I heard you say about they said, well, just get it in the hospital, and if you go into some shock, we'll. But I just like that. That sounds like a that's unbelievable that someone could utter that. Well, tell me, just since we touched on it, what the case that you, what the guy was retained? I forget. Was it Navy? I can't remember. I'm sure you got
Yes.
other, but there was a Navy guy, I think,
Yes.
enlisted. He was retained, but I think was he at like 20 years almost, or?
He was at he so he was prior enlisted and had switched in had been commissioned as an officer. So he had over 20 years, but he hadn't served the full 10 years as an officer to get the officer retirement. So that was the the issue.
Oh, yeah, he needs certain. So he was retained and able to serve until
Yes,
he got to. Okay.
he's still serving. He's
And
still.
how did the board members, what was the rationale? What did they say? I know you're a great attorney, so you convinced them, but what did they basically, what was their take on it? They were like,
Well,
yeah.
their biggest take on it was they had questions about the lawfulness of the order because of the availability of an FDA-approved product. And so to summarize that issue, and a lot of people aren't familiar with it, but this is what happened with the anthrax vaccine back in 2004 and 2005. There was some of the anthrax vaccine that was given to military members was not properly FDA approved. And so it was technically should have been considered an emergency use authorization or experimental product. So the federal courts ruled, hey, the government, the DoD can't force military members to take an EUA or experimental product unless the president signs a waiver. Back then, President Bush did not sign a waiver. That was the issue. That is an issue in some of these military cases today. That was the primary issue in Mosley's cases. The Navy couldn't demonstrate that an FDA-approved vaccine was being produced and made available within the United States. And again, it's a fascinating issue a lot of people aren't aware of, but a part of what happened is Pfizer at the time, there was no financial incentive for them to produce the FDA-approved formula. So they just were using the EUA formula, and that was what was being marketed. And so for a military member, and my client, we were able to show he would go to, if he went to the clinic to get to receive the vaccine, the product that was available was labeled EUA. It was an EUA product.
I see.
So
Okay.
that was the issue there. And it's still an issue in some cases, and there's some debate still about the availability of an FDA approved
Okay.
product.
And I don't know if you, I recently read something about the CDC is actually investigating something about the vaccine. I don't remember exactly. Are you familiar with that? It just came out like a couple
I
days ago.
am the CDC. My understanding is they're looking at a connection between the vaccine and strokes, particularly a certain type of stroke in those over 65 years of age. So that's something that the CDC is looking at, an increased risk. And we know other studies have shown a link to myocarditis, particularly in young, healthy individuals. So those are all things that we're still early on in dealing with. But again, this goes to congressional oversight of the Department of Defense. Congress passed, after the anthrax mess, Congress passed a law that says, hey, military, you cannot experiment on our soldiers. You cannot experiment on our service members. It has to be a fully, properly FDA approved product. So one of the things a lot of attorneys are looking at, one of the things I've been looking at, is not only concerns about the absence of long-term safety data on mRNA products, it's was the FDA approval process proper? Was it done properly? Did they follow the law in doing it? If they didn't, we're right back where we were with anthrax. And again, we can have differing opinions on the vaccine itself, but we don't have long-term studies on this vaccine because it hasn't been produced for very long, right? So we don't have 5 and 10 year studies. So that's a concern for a lot of my clients. It's a concern that I have. So, I think there's a lot more to come that's going to have to be dealt with. But the issue that I have that's near and dear to me and to you as well when it comes to the military is we need a, you know, we recruiting, retention, morale is a big issue because when military members find out about the way religious accommodation requests were handled, when they find out about some of these medical exemption cases that were just such injustices, that's not good for the military. We need strong leadership. We need to follow the law. We need to do things right, even if it's an emergency, even if it's sort of an unprecedented emergency like COVID-19. We have laws for a reason. We're a nation of laws. So one of my concerns, and a lot of the work that I'm going to continue to be doing is, and you did this as a defense counsel, is hold people accountable to follow the law. Let's do it right. The Constitution matters. These rights and freedoms, they matter. We need to take care of our service members.
So with the going back to Colonel King, like, so what are you kind of doing? Are you looking at the avenues, what you said with the FDA approval, that type of stuff? Or are you just waiting for guidance? Or what exactly are you doing?
Yeah, we're
as you can discuss it.
What I can share is this is, you know, I am very curious to see what the official Air Force specific guidance is going to be and what the guidance for the reserves is going to be. And then based on that, we'll pursue all the appropriate options. You know, we may have to go through the Board of Corrections. It will be interesting to see what happens. And again, there may be more congressional involvement. You know, just like we're in a wait and see game for 9,000 plus that have already been discharged. Most of them submitted a religious accommodation request, and a significant number, if not most, received a general discharge. So now they're kicked out. They have a general discharge, so they've lost a GI Bill. They've lost GI Bill, some other benefits, and they have a DD-214. And their DD-214 and the reason for separation says misconduct, commission of a serious offense.
Oh, so, I was going to ask you that. Is that what it says on
there?
That's
what it says.
Because it's the violation of the lawful order.
Right.
Is that what it's?
That's
is,
right.
Is that what that's the LOR right. say? Violation.
That's right.
Of the law. Let me ask you. So I know there's a case pending. I don't know if you're involved with that, with 26 Navy SEALs, a class action. Are you familiar with that one?
I am. I have clients that are Navy SEALs. I'm not a named attorney in that case, but I've worked very closely on it.
Okay. And that one, I think the court ruled in their favor, right? Do you know what? I just read about that. I was curious where they are, if you know.
Yeah. So that case is in a very similar position as two other cases. So that's the Texas case that impacted the Navy. It started with the Navy SEALs, and then it was an injunction for all Navy, anyone that submitted a religious accommodation. That was the Navy. Then there was an Air Force, similar Air Force case in Ohio, made the same ruling. That judge made the same ruling. And then there's a case in Florida for the Marine Corps, same ruling. The Army case is still pending an injunction. It's very, very close. It's out there. And then circuit courts, the federal circuit courts that have taken appeals of that injunction have all ruled in favor of the service members. So that's where things stand right now. The issue is the Department of Defense and the Department of Justice have said to those judges, hey, we don't need to go to trial because there's no mandate anymore. And that's what I alluded to earlier.
Okay.
So for my, you know, for example, for my Navy SEAL clients, many of them have been kicked out because the injunction didn't come down in time to help them. Others were forced to retire early. Others are in that situation we talked about with adverse paperwork, as well as non-employable status, as well as performance reports that are messed up. So there's still remedies that the court could give them. So the attorneys involved in all of those cases, all of us are advocating for the cases to go to trial anyway. And the indications are that they will. I actually expect the case in Florida, the Marine Corps case, could go to trial as early as February.
Okay. You know, I'm wondering, I'm going to wrap up the interview soon, but I'm just wondering and talking to you, you know, that once this rescission, the mandate rescission occurred, like the ones who were fighting and kind of still not discharged, I wonder how, you know, what percentage of them are like, oh, wow, thank God I can serve and continue. And what percentage of them are, wow, I'm like kind of tired and I'm going to, I guess, just separate, you know, I just wonder, I don't know if you have an idea in talking to people or.
You know, I have to stay anecdotal in that, right? I can't say for sure what the numbers are across the board, but in the individuals I'm speaking to, and I have over 70 clients in some stage of this process, morale is not high.
Yeah.
Morale is not high. Most, including Navy SEALs and others, are not have a difficult time seeing themselves serving for another 8 or 10 years to finish out their career. Those that are very close to retirement, I think, can see a way to that. But there are many that have no interest.
But Davis, so just to wrap it up, you might remember as like every last question I like to ask attorneys is, you know, since the name of the pod, Military Law and Life Matters, You know, based on just, you know, what's happened, et cetera. Is there anything you can share, like a lesson as it pertains to this that will be helpful maybe to military members listening who are either, you know, affected by this mandate or maybe not? Anything you could think of that you might want to share with members?
Well, I think there is a lot, but I think one of the most important things is we all have to. There are times in our careers as service members, there are times in life when we have to decide what is most important. Character, integrity, the law, the Constitution, are those things most important? Or are we just going to simply ignore those when there's an emergency? And that's difficult. That can be difficult, especially when we're dealing with something that many, many people felt surprised by, ill-equipped for, just felt unprecedented with regard to COVID. So it was a very difficult time for everyone. But there's a lot of important lessons to be learned about, you know, in many respects, we have a constitution, we have laws in place to protect our service members, to protect critical rights like religious freedom for emergencies. And if we're just going to ignore those things in emergencies or for political reasons, we're going to make mistakes and it's going to have consequences. So I think that's the biggest thing that we can learn. We have to understand the principles that underscore our Constitution and the importance of following the law, even when it's challenging, even when it's difficult. And I think we have to learn, even within the military structure, we have to learn how to communicate effectively up and down the chain of command and with each other. And the idea that rank and file service members are going to look up to and respect and want to follow a commander that says, hey, sorry, we have to do this. I understand you have concerns, but this is what senior leaders are telling me. You know, that sort of mentality, while it is part of military service, it exposes sort of bureaucratic or weak leaders. And I think we need to learn from that. We need to be willing to say, you know what, I understand your concerns. I'm going to take your concerns and I'm going to make sure somebody hears them. I'm not saying that they're going to agree. I'm not saying I agree, but we're going to at least make sure your questions are answered and these concerns are heard. And that's not what happened with these religious accommodation requests or these medical exemptions. And we need to learn from that.
Yeah. And guess what? Those are the leaders you'll follow right into the battle, right? The
people That's right.
Who you feel hears you, who cares, whether they agree or not, but who
That's
cares?
Right.
Like, you know, because not everyone agrees with everything, right? In the military, you may not
That's
agree,
right.
but
right.
it's like everyone's different. And those are the type, just, you know, being the military, those type of people are the ones you will, you know, go right into battle for. Davis, thanks so much for coming back on and for doing what you do. I guess when you're retired, you had a great career, but now you can focus on, you know, your civilian, because reservists, obviously, that takes, you know, time out of your life and practice. So now you can focus on these cases and other cases that you're working on. It gives you more time to do that. Focus on your passion, which is obviously, I know it's a passion for you, helping fight injustice.
That's right. I'm looking forward to that. And definitely there's a lot of work to be done. So thank you so much for talking about these issues. And hopefully some folks out there will benefit from knowing what options they have moving forward.
Yeah. It was very educational. Thank you so much. And that the whole point is to educate. I got educated by talking to you, but the point is to have people who, you know, maybe have an interest or in these situations, it could help them. So thanks so much, Davis. We'll talk to you again, maybe depending on what happens in the future. So thanks again for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
So I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Attorney Davis Yance. Davis gave us a very good rundown on the DOD memo, what it means, the issues the memo addressed, as well as the many unaddressed issues that are still pending. There was a lot of discussion on how this mandate affected some very outstanding service members and how this is just the first step, because there's a lot of service members still in limbo. I mean, one thing I know is that, you know, in January 2020, the CDC reported the first confirmed case of COVID in the U.S., and the rest is history. Like, the entire world went into a crisis mode based on a worldwide pandemic that was unknown. It was emergency actions going on. And there's no doubt in my mind, based on what the Department of Defense knew at the time, they issued this mandate in August 2021 requiring all service members and Department of Defense to be mandated to get the COVID vaccine. And it was based on their belief that they had a compelling interest in mission accomplishment, responsibility to ensure the health and safety of military members, and to maintain military readiness as a defense armed force. I mean, I really have no doubt about this. This is basically as stated in the DOD memo. But as Davis noted, the issue here is that he's contending with is that the Department of Defense, he believes, did not properly evaluate these religious accommodation requests. And there's some courts that agreed they did not properly address them as required by the First Amendment to the Constitution and federal law, and as well as some of these medical exemptions requests, as you heard him discuss some cases, which sounded quite unusual to me as he recounted it. And we know that the military members who had a very strong conviction in this regard are now facing the consequences of their conviction. And while the vaccine mandate has been lifted, the lives of so many of these members are really still in limbo. It's just the first step. There's members, as he discussed, the Lieutenant Colonel Reservist, who's kind of in a limbo status. So again, while the vaccine mandate has been lifted, it's the first step and of trying to get back to normalcy. And we'll see what happens. A lot of unaddressed things, a lot of service members, again, you know, outstanding members who really had some conviction. It wasn't, you know, they sincerely, I believe, had a conviction to, and that's why they refused the vaccine. And as I said, they're facing the consequences for that. So, regardless of the issue you're contending with, it's always a good idea to get an expert opinion when you're facing a difficult legal issue in your life. Consulting with an attorney who is an expert in the issue, in the matters, who specializes perhaps in these issues, will give you insight into the issue and help you come up with a strategic plan to solve the matter. I just really believe that generally, ignoring a problem does not make it go away, no matter how difficult it may seem. Confronting the issue head on with smart counsel on your side will give you peace of mind and give you closure one way or another. So, as I said, most of the time, issues just don't resolve on their own. And, you know, you can make a decision on whether you want to pursue it or maybe say you're not going to pursue it. So at least it's out of your mind and you don't have that cluttering up your mind. So, I'd ask you if you enjoy the podcast, if you're learning it, please share learning anything from it. Please share it with people you know who might benefit. If you can, go to iTunes and please give it a nice five-star review, a rating on iTunes so that maybe other people can become aware of it. It can get more, I don't know how the algorithms work, but, you know, the more people who review it and enjoy it, they can get the word out on that. So, anyway, that's what I ask you to do if you don't mind. And as I always say, remember, never, ever give up because there is always hope. I look forward to talking to you next time. Take care.